This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Mike Waldridge, and I'm talking to Australian peace activist Donna Mulhern about her decision to go to Iraq as a human shield to try to prevent the West from going to war with Saddam Hussein. It didn't succeed, but does she still think she did the right thing?
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. In one very clear sense, Donald Trump is being true to his word. He promised a clear win in the election, which he got. And he promised to take on what he sees as the establishment in Washington, the officials and the agencies which so infuriated him during his first term in office. And so it has proved, at least in terms of his wish list for his most senior executives. This time yesterday, we were talking about Mr. Trump's provocative picks for Attorney General and Director of National Intelligence. Today, it's the man he wants to be his health secretary. This was the president-elect making the announcement on Thursday in his first speech since election night.
Another one who's another great mind and a great guy and so popular, and I think he's right. He wants to make people healthy. It's driven him pretty wild over the last number of years, and the Democrats didn't treat him well. He was doing fantastically well, and today I nominated him for, I guess, if you like health and if you like people that live a long time, it's the most important position, RFK Jr. Bobby?
Robert Kennedy Jr. is a nephew of the former Democratic President John F. Kennedy. He himself had a long-shot campaign for the presidency this year, based in large part on his previous vociferous championing of, among other things, scepticism about vaccines and a cocktail of conspiracy theories. Here he is on two occasions speaking during this campaign.
COVID-19 is targeted to attack Caucasians and black people. The people who are most immune are Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese.
I do believe that autism does come from vaccines. All I've said about vaccines, we should have good science. We should have the same kind of testing, placebo-controlled trials, that we have for every other medication.
Mr. Kennedy abandoned his presidential campaign in August to back Donald Trump. Lauren Weber is health and science accountability reporter at The Washington Post and joins us now. Lauren, thank you for your time. He will, if he becomes health and human services secretary, look after 13 agencies or 13 divisions. We can't go through all of them, but what are the big ticket ones?
Well, I mean, to start with, it's nearly $2 trillion worth of money that he'll be overseeing amid these health agencies. But the big ticket ones is he'll be in charge of looking after Americans' insurance through the Center for CMS. He'll be in charge of looking after our food and drugs through the Food and Drug Administration. He'll be in charge of directing and somewhat dictating what the research of America goes to, obviously with Congress weighing in as well through the NIH. And then National Institute for Health, yes. And then the CDC's, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is famed often around the world for its research on outbreaks and science. He will also be in charge of that. And as you played some of his clips before I began talking, he has a record of saying debunked and anti-science sentiment. Mm. So many scientific experts have been quite alarmed by this appointment.
Well, I guess the next question, and maybe our final question, because we haven't got much time, is just how far he would have the power to direct the science.
Well, he has the bully pulpit to start with, right? So he can stand up there and say the various things that he believes in. But on top of that, there are different mechanisms. He could tell the CDC he doesn't want to see vaccines recommended anymore. He could, set different research priorities for these different administrations. He could, lobby too through the White House, through Donald Trump, to help push Congress to achieve his objectives. So he's set to have quite a sweeping role.
Lauren Weber, Health and Science Accountability Reporter at the Washington Post. Thank you very much for your time. We will hear from someone from within the public health field who's got concerns about this appointment. In fact, someone who's worked very closely in the past with Anthony Fauci, the man who helped lead America's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. You might remember his name. And who has since become a target for people like Robert Kennedy Jr. Indeed, Mr. Kennedy even wrote a damning book all about Anthony Fauci. We'll have that interview coming up. Let's hear first, though, from an enthusiast for RFK Jr. Corey Lewandowski was a senior advisor to Donald Trump's 2024 election campaign. Why does he think Bobby Kennedy is the right man for the job?
What I say is it's so interesting that just 4 short years ago, RFK Jr. was being considered to be the head of the Environmental Protection Agency here in the United States by the Biden administration. And the pundits and the media lauded him as a fantastic pick, exceptionally qualified to oversee environmental protection. But now that Donald Trump has chosen him to be the head of Health and Human Services, those same very people are saying not only is he unqualified, but he's not a serious candidate. And it just goes to show you the level of Trump derangement syndrome, that when one person is selected by one party, they are lauded as an expert in their field, even though they have no formal training. And when that same person is selected by another party, they are lauded or jeered as someone who is unserious and unqualified.
Except one only has to listen to some of the things that RFK Jr. has said himself about issues that do pertain to health. He's parroted the conspiracy theory that childhood vaccines cause autism, no proof. He's talked about raw milk being a good thing. The FDA says it's very risky. He's said that the National Institutes for Health should move away from fighting infectious diseases when we don't know when the next pandemic is going to be. I mean, these are things that are potentially very dangerous, aren't they?
We should have to look at this in a holistic nature. And if we believe that Dr. Fauci, who oversaw a significant portion of our pandemic response, did justice to either the people of the United States or the world, then we are fundamentally wrong with our assessment. We have seen the politicalization of the Department of Health and Human Services, the mandating of vaccines for government employees with no proof that they were going to work. We don't know the long-term ramifications of those vaccines that people were forced to take in order to keep their jobs. And what RFK Jr. has said was, the same products which are being sold in separate countries are using different ingredients, and the ingredients they're using here in the United States are designed to hook children on products which are not healthy. And we don't have a healthy country. So if the goal of the Department of Health and Human Services is to make sure that the American population is as healthy as possible, then I think the outside-the-box thinking that RFK Jr. brings to that is something that we should embrace and see what occurs should he be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, which I believe he will be.
I just heard you say that COVID vaccines haven't been proven to work, and that's not true. I mean, we do know that they work.
We don't know that. Here's what we know. We were told that masks would prevent the spread of COVID. We know that to be a fallacy.
Really?
We were told that standing, absolutely, Dr. Fauci has said that himself.
I think Anthony Fauci, he certainly did concede that the understanding of the way in which that disease spread and the way it could be mitigated against, that science developed over time. What we do know now is that, I mean, the stuff that RFK Jr. has recently been caught on camera saying, for example, that COVID-19 was targeted to attack Caucasians and black people, Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese are most immune. I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it?
Don't we think that this whole notion of COVID, where Dr. Fauci is still not acknowledged that this came out of the Wuhan laboratory in China and has this false notion that this was spread by some random monkey at a wet lab, is such a fallacy that the Center for Disease Control and his organization has lost all credibility in the scientific community in America?
You keep
America.
On going on about Dr. Fauci. I'm sorry to interrupt, Corey, because
the Secretary
he's
of
not
Health
due
Human
to be
Services,
the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
That's right. And that is an individual who has jurisdiction over these government agencies. And if we had somebody in the last 4 years, who oversaw the work of Dr. Fauci and pushed back on his fallacies, maybe more Americans would be alive today.
You talked about your hope that he will be confirmed by the Senate. I just wonder whether some Republican senators actually might have a problem with that approach of, in a sense, trying to regulate the food industry more. I mean, it smacks of what we in Britain, I don't know if you have the same phrase in the United States, call nanny state. This idea that government is telling you what you can and can't do. That's not going to sit very well with Republican senators, is it?
Well, but hasn't the government here in the United States told us what we can and can't do on a regular basis over the last 4 years?
But that's what you seem to be complaining about.
Absolutely, we're complaining about that. But I don't think there's any Republican or Democrat United States senator that says we condone childhood obesity. We support the products that are going into our children when the very same product, the very same cereal sent to a different country uses different products. And listen, Bobby Kennedy uses this example all the time. You have three ingredients that go into McDonald's French fries in the United Kingdom. One happens to be a potato, one happens to be salt, and the other one is an oil. In the United States, we have 17 different items that go into one batch of McDonald's French fries. So the question is, what are those 14 additional additives that our children are consuming and our adults are consuming here in the United States that aren't being consumed in the UK? And are those healthy?
It is I don't know if irony is the right word, but it's striking that Donald Trump, who's a man who loves his fast food, he loves his
McDonald's French fries.
He loves his fossil fuels, and he's buddying up with a guy who hates fast foods and has been an environmental lawyer who wants to wean America off its addiction to fossil fuels, and yet they're making common cause over the Health and Human Services Department.
Well, and you have to remember what Donald Trump has said. Bobby Kennedy is not going to touch what we call liquid gold, which is that beautiful oil underneath our soil. He's not going to have anything to do with that.
You know, one of the observations that has been made, I mean, not just about RFK Jr. as the health secretary, but of course about Matt Gaetz as attorney general, Tulsi Gabbard as director of national intelligence, is that Mr. Trump is trying to test the Senate just to see how far he can push through his mandate. What do you make of that?
I think President Trump is coming to Washington, D.C. with a mandate, not just in the Electoral College, but also with the popular vote. And more than that, if you look at what his coattails produced, is now a majority of Republicans in the United States Senate because of his wins in Pennsylvania, his helping in Montana, his helping in the state of Ohio. And because of that, the president's prerogative and the Senate's obligation is to allow the president to select people who he believes are best fit for the positions, and the advice and consent rules in the Senate give them the authority to vet those candidates and their credentials and approve or not approve them. Now, the last time a nominee of any candidate was actually voted down in the U.S. Senate was 1989, and his name was Tower. John Tower was the last one. So it is very, very rare that any president actually allows an individual to be considered for a vote and the U.S. Senate votes that person down. Historically speaking, a president will pull a nomination should he believe that the candidate is not going to make it through the Senate confirmation process. But through the sheer will and the political resources we have at our disposal, I believe all of Donald Trump's nominations will make it through the United States Senate.
Corey Lewandowski, an advisor to Donald Trump, will hear a response from a top figure in American public health very shortly here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, the big social media sites and age verification. We'll hear about possible plans in Australia to make the companies ensure children cannot access unsuitable content.
They haven't been required to age verify children online. There's been a degree of almost willful blindness in terms of they know there are underage users on their platforms. They haven't had to do anything about it, but now they will.
More on that in just over 10 minutes. The headlines in the BBC newsroom this hour. Millions of people in northern Pakistan have been told to remain indoors as a health emergency is declared over choking toxic smog. And there have been allegations that the Israeli Prime Minister's chief of staff tried to alter phone records to make it look as though Benjamin Netanyahu acted quicker during last year's attack by Hamas. You with NewsHour, live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks, and back to our top story, Donald Trump nominating a prominent vaccine skeptic, in fact, probably the most prominent vaccine skeptic in the US, as the man he wants to be as Secretary of Health and Human Services. We just heard a strong endorsement of Robert Kennedy Jr. from a senior advisor to Mr. Trump. What's the view from among public health professionals? Dr. Tom Freedom has held one of the top positions in the US. He's a former head of the Centers for Disease Control. He's a specialist in infectious diseases and public health. Dr. Freedom, welcome to NewsHour. Your response to this nomination?
The Secretary of Health and Human Services has a life or death responsibility. If that individual doesn't get it right, more people die, whether it's from pandemics or chronic disease. And he has an awesome responsibility that includes not only the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but also the Food and Drug Administration, the main funder of healthcare in the US, what's called CMS. So it's a very important position. And the risk is that unscientific ideas will damage agencies and undermine confidence in public health and result in more preventable illness and death. There is a way forward if there is clarity and science instead of rumor and profiteering. If there are proven approaches that are used, it's possible to really make progress rather than do PR. And I think one of the litmus tests will be whether, if confirmed, RFK Jr. will take on the known major causes of chronic disease. It's great,
which is
that
which indeed is something
on
that he has emphasized, that he is very concerned about chronic disease, about obesity, about ultra processed foods and so forth.
Yes, but the main known proven causes are tobacco, alcohol, sugary drinks, and pollution in the form of particulate matter 2.5 or soot. And there are proven strategies to reduce those by taxing tobacco, taxing alcohol, taxing sugary drinks, regulating the amount of nicotine that is put into tobacco products by the tobacco industry, regulating alcohol. These are proven strategies to reduce chronic disease. So if you're serious about it, you'll take those strategies.
And would that be enough to act as a counterweight to what I presume is your concern about his approach, for example, to vaccines? I mean, him saying we need to ask more questions before we can be certain whether they are safe.
I think it's very problematic. In the U.S., we have a best practice, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. It has no industry influence. It uses the best science. Every meeting is live streamed and available on the web. Every document is available to the public. And there is an open and transparent weighing of the considerations. Now, the ACIP, that committee, makes recommendations to the CDC director. And it's up to the CDC director whether or not to adopt those recommendations. So the amount of damage that could be done if an unscientific approach, like the one you just heard about, is promoted is quite substantial.
And I suppose that it's not just about the direction of future travel in terms of research, but presumably if, for example, parents are deciding we would rather that our kids were not vaccinated whilst we listen to RFK Jr. pose all these questions, that can have an effect in itself.
Absolutely. What we saw for decades now from the falsification of data in the UK, actually, that alleged to show an association of measles and autism, that has been disproven repeatedly, but it continues to undermine vaccine confidence in countries around the world and is one of the reasons we still have measles outbreaks. And each year, or this year, more than 100,000 children around the world will die from measles. Vaccines are one of the greatest accomplishments of humanity. They have saved literally hundreds of millions of lives. And yes, we need to look very carefully. We need to see who should get them and when, and continue to track in case there's a problem. But undermining vaccine confidence undermines health.
May I ask you a yes or no question, which is, should RFK Jr. be endorsed by senators to be the next health secretary?
I'm not a senator, so I don't vote on that question. I'm not a politician, so I don't want to weigh in. What I would say is that if indeed he's serious about making America healthier, there are proven ways to do that.
Tom Frieden, we'll leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us. Now, some news to bring you from Italy. It's a wonderful story from the Italian Alps. It seems that two hikers have discovered an entire prehistoric ecosystem through the footprints of creatures from almost 300 million years ago, revealed by melting snow and ice. Elio Della Ferrera is a professional wildlife photographer who saw the first image snapped by the couple, who happened to be old friends of his.
Claudia Stefan sent the picture to us. I knew them from 30 years ago. I was impressed by the discovery because the piece of stone where there was fossil traces was the same as a beach, a riverside, with some small footprints of ancestral amphibians. So after that, I started to research to find other evidence of the discovery. And across several weeks, I found quite a lot of traces, imprints of reptiles, of amphibians from 280 million years ago during the Permian period.
Which was before the dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's about 60 million years earlier than dinosaur.
When you saw this, this first image, did you realize immediately the potential significance of what they had literally stumbled on?
Yeah, I was impressed. I understand immediately that that place was plenty of that kind of fossil traces. So I was very fascinated by this discovery, and I started to go repeatedly. I went there dozens of times. So I completed last week this kind of research, and I photographed and mapped all the discoveries.
Can you just take us there? Describe what the area is like.
It's a comfortable hiking, but it's quite long, 1.5 hours, about 6 kilometers, I think. At the head of the valley, there are steep mountain walls, rocky walls, cliffs, every kind of steep places, sometimes quite dangerous because a stone fell just 20 meters away from me one time. It's a difficult place to reach because it's just stone, rocks, boulders, all the kind of rockies, and with vertical rocky walls.
I wonder what you think, Elio, about the fact that this magnificent discovery really only came about because of climate change, because the ice and the snow on these rocks had melted. Oh. It's a little bit sad, isn't it?
Yeah, that is really sad because I'm a nature photographer from a long time ago, and I saw all the higher part of the Italian Alps 30, 40 years ago with lots of snow and glaciers in very well conditions at that time. But year by year, you can see the glacier disappear.
Elio Della Ferrera speaking to me from Northern Italy. This is NewsHour.
Witness the stories that have shaped our world.
On the launch pad, in the dawn light, a towering symbol of an ambitious nation.
3, 2, 1.
The whole of India was watching.
Told by the people who were there.
I still don't regret that I was part of Rose Revolution. I was a witness of very exciting days.
Witness history from the BBC World Service. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It's been the cry of many parents around the world in recent years, how to protect their kids from the excesses and dangers of social media. Next week, Australia's Parliament will debate new legislation proposing a social media ban for under-16s. The measures would involve trying out age verification systems to block children from accessing social media sites such as Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and X. The BBC's Rachel Burden has been hearing more from Australia's e-safety commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant.
We spent 2 years putting together an age verification roadmap, and we've seen the technology evolve quite a bit. Right now, the government is looking at an age verification trial so we can test this. We've gone to the platforms to assess their age assurance readiness. You know, right now, most of the platforms do provide something called age gating, which basically a kid can lie and prevaricate about it, his or her age. And we found through recent youth research that we released last month that already 84% of Australian 8 to 12-year-olds are on social media sites, and only 13% of them have ever been suspended for being underage on these platforms. So because this is a new regulatory field and they haven't been required to age verify children online, there's been a degree of almost willful blindness in terms of they know there are underage users on their platforms. They haven't had to do anything about it, but now they will. And I would also add that the UK and Ireland have age assurance codes coming out. And one of the reasons I'm in the UK is I just spent all day yesterday at Ofcom with 9 other online safety regulators as part of the Global Online Safety Regulatory Network. And so we're working closely together because these are global challenges that require global solutions.
Well, they are. But one of the huge concerns around this is that for age verification to be effective, you need to essentially gather massive amounts and hold on to massive amounts of data. And there are quite reasonable privacy concerns around that, worries that that sort of information could be accessed, misused?
Yes. I mean, all of this has been canvassed before. It was canvassed by the BBFC under the Digital Economy Act in 2018. We've canvassed it. The technology and the ecosystem has come a long way. But, you know, this is ultimately going to be up to the platforms to determine this. But it's in no one's interest for these companies to create a honeypot of information that is vulnerable to data breaches or any security breaches or to violate anyone's privacy.
But there's huge financial value in holding this amount of information, isn't there?
Well, I mean, the whole surveillance social media economy is driven by data. And so this will be working very closely with our privacy commissioner to ensure that we have three legs of the stool that are equal, that we're looking after the safety of children, that we're making sure that this is done securely and that privacy is protected.
And that was the Australian e-safety commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant. You're with the BBC World Service, live from London. This is NewsHour. I'm Tim Franks. As the first week of this year's UN climate talks draws to a close, what progress has been made? Or is that actually the wrong question? In a moment, we'll hear from one of the high-level signatories of a letter who've said that these annual summits are proving frustratingly inefficient at delivering the sort of profound and rapid changes the planet needs. But one question we could ask right now is whether the delegates have made any headway on what our environment correspondent Matt McGrath told us when COP29 opened was possibly the number one discussion point this year: how to get the money for climate financing. In other words, the increasingly vast amounts of money needed, in particular by poorer and more vulnerable countries, to prepare for and fight against the worst effects of climate change. Mafalda Duarte is CEO of the largest global fund set up by the UN to deal with that, the Green Climate Fund.
So the Green Climate Fund is a global fund that invests in developing countries, from energy to agriculture to water. We help developing countries meet their climate and development ambitions in terms of prosperity, economic development, jobs, minimization of impacts of climate change and disasters.
Would you accept that in terms of your role in the Green Climate Fund, I mean, there is a huge gap between what is needed and what you are able to affect?
Correct. There's a huge gap, and I think it's widely recognized. And the reason why this COP29, one of the key objectives is to negotiate and agree on a new quantified goal in terms of finance to be provided to developing countries to meet Our global climate goals, these have to be efforts across multiple dimensions.
There is a debate as to whether certain countries need to do more. There is a particular question, for example, over whether a country like China, the largest emitter of CO2 last year, the second largest economy in the world, should be contributing more, whether those states that are fossil fuel exporters should be doing more.
All countries need to do more. Every single country needs to look at what are they doing? Are they doing enough and sufficiently in terms of domestic action? Do they have harmful subsidies that they should be redirecting? Do they have untapped sources of tax revenues they could be tapping into? Do they have the necessary standards? Are they doing enough to unlock their private capital?
And I guess another important message, as far as people such as you are concerned, is that the longer people wait to effect change, the more expensive it is going to get.
Absolutely. And we are already seeing that.
I just wonder how much sympathy you've got for this open letter that's been signed today to say that actually this process of annual UN summits just doesn't work, because we need to stop thinking endlessly about these sort of once a year negotiations and think more about implementation throughout the year.
I have said it before myself that we need to move away from the type of COP where it's just about new announcements to COPs that are about accountability.
Mafalda Duarte, CEO of the UN's Green Climate Fund. So what of that question I asked her, whether the best way to get change is to have these annual high-level summits, or are they failing to deliver? A group of top-level climate policy experts have today released a letter demanding that these annual Conference of the Parties, or COPs, as they're called, we're now on COP29, be overhauled as a matter of urgency. Among the signatories is Sandrine Dixon de Clèves, the president of the think tank, the Club of Rome. Why does she think the process isn't working?
We started to feel that, first of all, starting at Sharm el-Sheikh, but also continuing at Dubai, there seemed to be more and more people coming to the COPs, less and less focus on delivering ambition and really streamlining the COP for speed and scale. But also we've seen a tendency of shifting away from meetings between the COPs and the diplomacy that's necessary, that should be undertaken by presidencies, to really have the necessary conversations, those difficult conversations around transitioning, for example, out of energy, fossil fuel energy, into a very different type of energy infrastructure. And so our worries were only getting increasingly enhanced, in particular earlier this week, although we'd been preparing this letter and the release. But to see that the COP presidency last week had negotiated contracts with oil and gas companies prior to the COP, had enabled about 132, I think, executives to be under the badge system of the presidency itself, coming from the fossil energy sector. And also, in addition, opened up the COP process with a very strong statement about the importance of fossil fuel energy. So there just seems to be a disconnect between the ambition that we need and the moves that we need to ensure that we have less shocks and stresses from climate impacts.
The question, though, is about the process. And these COP summits, one of the things about them is that they do focus attention and they do impose a certain sort of deadline.
I guess the key question we're asking ourselves is, how is it that we can now truly shift towards action and implementation, towards transitioning, which was one of the key successes coming out of the last COP in Dubai? But if we truly are going to have that conversation around transitioning, why is that not happening at this time? And do we feel that we actually will get a negotiated deal on climate finance, which has also been a real sticking point in terms of the $100 billion that has been promised, and also in terms of the damage and loss fund that probably could have been negotiated a much higher figure? So all of these promises that have been made really truly have to now come into some level of implementation.
You talked about your disappointment that the president of Azerbaijan, which of course is hosting this summit, him talking about fossil fuels in Azerbaijan being a gift from God. I guess the counter argument is that the whole process is bringing in all 195 or however many countries. You know, it can't just be a few countries pushing on ahead. It's supposed to be every single country buying into this process. So you do have to bring along the skeptics and the laggards. That's just part of the deal. It's also part of the strength of this process.
Absolutely. And the only thing I would say to that is then let's put in place a proper process so that we actually have those conversations.
But what does that proper process look like?
That we unpack what are we going to do about those countries that are so dependent on fossil energy? What does it look like for them to transition? What does it look like to start to engage in a real conversation with private oil and gas companies, who, by the way, for the moment are making upwards of 2.8 billion in windfall profits per day on the back of that growing energy poverty?
And that was Sandrine Dixon-Declerc, president of the Club of Rome. The BBC's environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, is covering this summit for us in the Azerbaijani capital, Baku, and joins us now. Matt, can we begin with this this letter of displeasure about the COP process? I mean, you would have heard expressions of dissatisfaction many, many times over the years. What do you make of this one?
I think that's right, Tim. Many of the arguments made in this letter about reforming this process, the climate talks process, have been made before by many of the same people. I think their timing is interesting, and I think they've picked up on the comments made by the Azerbaijan president here, other actions going on, and a general sense of concern that not enough progress is being made here on an issue like climate finance, as well as that in the background. Then you have the ongoing issues with President Trump, like the pullout from the COP here. A lot of things not going spectacularly well in this process, and they feel, I guess, they need to say something, and they want to say something right now. I think that the general sense, though, is that trying to reform something as massive as this is an incredibly difficult undertaking, given that the shortness of time to make the massive steps that need to be made to keep the world relatively safe. So I think the people here, the reaction has been, yes, they understand those, the need to reform, but they also understand that right now this is the only show in town and the only way of taking the steps that need to be taken in the time frame we need to take them.
And I guess there is that sort of philosophical difference, isn't there, about whether you should go at the pace of arguably what is needed and what the most reforming countries want to do, or whether it is a multinational process involving 195 or however many countries, and you have part of the strength of the system is that you do try and embrace them all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the G20 group is meeting this weekend. They provide 80% of the emissions in the world. So getting progress amongst them, you would think, would be a major step forward. But here in the COP, in the Conference of the Parties, it's the moral weight of the world. It's the moral argument for looking after the least developed countries, the small island states. They're the conscience of this place, and they're the ones who, by dint of their personalities and pressure, force the bigger emitters to do something. You don't get that at a G20 or a G7. This process does kind of work in a very slow-moving, difficult way, but it does get some agreement and it does essentially move forward. Always the difficulty here is the speed and the difficulty. And, of course, we're now right into a very difficult argument about money, which an argument that nobody ever wants to have an argument about. But that's front and center.
Yeah.
And, a lot of the richer countries are looking at their shoes.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, Matt, and I name-checked you at the top of this sequence because you introduced that question of climate financing right on the first day of the summit. I just wonder what your sense of a few days in of the sort of the pace of progress, if any.
the progress is incredibly slow. I mean, on across the COP, this particular, there are 100 items that need agreeing on different tracks, as they call them, different aspects of not just finance, but everything else as well. So far, around half of those have no text at all, and we're halfway through the COP. Ministers are going to come here on Monday to face this big decision about climate finance. They're facing a 35-page document that's just got oodles and oodles and oodles of options in there. It hasn't been refined at all. That's a very difficult and challenging task. They may well be able to, by the end of this week, cobble together some form of agreement on some large amount of money that on paper might look good, but there's a big worry that it might just be on paper and not a real solid agreement that many people here in the world needs.
And I guess that underpins so much of this, isn't it? That, you know, it's all very well to come up with ideas, but sort of mechanisms to ensure their implementation is another thing.
Yeah, measuring, reporting, verifying has always been the bugbear of this particular conference, and we have lots of great promises over the years not met. Promised to make 100 billion available to poor countries by 2020, met 2 years later. So there's a lot of mistrust and a lot of worry that you won't be able to come up with the system essentially in a week now to work out how do you handle $1 trillion a year, which is the kind of money and figures we're talking about. So I think there's a lot of concern that it may not work out so well.
Matt McGrath, our environment correspondent, indefatigable at our in COP29 at the Azerbaijani capital, Baku, for us. This is NewsHour. Now, one of those widely blamed for the devastating impact of flash floods in the Spanish region of Valencia last month was the president of the region. Carlos Mazón has now apologised. He said emergency procedures in place were inadequate, but the authorities had been trying to deal with an unprecedented weather situation. Mr. Mathon was heavily criticised for taking several hours to send out emergency warnings to residents after a red alert was issued by the Spanish Weather Agency. Almost 220 people died in the floods. He was speaking to the local parliament.
No hay referencia anterior posible, ni experiencia que pueda ser remotamente asimilable.
There is no previous reference or experience that could be remotely comparable to this disaster. All of this now explains why there was a widespread feeling that aid was not arriving and was insufficient. For this reason, as president of the local government, I want to apologize to those who felt this way. Because although the protocols that had been designed and tested many times in the past were applied, their response capabilities were insufficient.
Carlos Mazón, the president of the Spanish region of Valencia. Now back to our top story. In addition to nominating RFK Jr. to head the Department of Health, Donald Trump has told supporters at a gala at his Mar-a-Lago resort on Thursday evening that the Russia-Ukraine war has got to stop. He said it would be a priority when he takes office in January. His pick for Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has said that America is funding a stalemate war in Ukraine, which needs to be brought to an end. Each of Mr. Trump's top foreign policy appointments have also questioned the basis of NATO at current spending levels and are sceptical about what they see as subsidies for Europe's inadequate spending on defence. What does all this mean for the future of European security? Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman has this report from Washington.
As one group of tourists files past, this is Congress, and I'm standing below the gleaming dome of the US Capitol building, shining white in the November sunshine. And this is the very heart of American democracy. Excuse me, guys. Sorry to bother you. I'm from BBC.
BBC.
Okay. I just wondered if I can ask you, what do you think about taxpayer dollars funding weapons to Ukraine?
I think the amount that we've supported them, might want to ease that one back a little bit, throttle back on that.
I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, you would think they would have made a little more inroads in that war with that kind of money.
Soon, the Senate will be asked to confirm Donald Trump's choices to lead his America First foreign policy. First among them, as Secretary of State, Marco Rubio.
At the end of the day, what we are funding here is a stalemate war, and it needs to be brought to a conclusion.
Who this year voted against U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. Then there's the Trump nominee for Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, who wants to build pressure
on allies who haven't been paying up and ponying up the way they should for this key alliance.
Like the boss, he's a NATO skeptic. and to the White House without a nod from the Senate will be the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz.
Let's move to burden sharing. The United States provided $30 billion in security assistance. The next nearest is Germany at $3.5 billion. UK, less than $3 billion. Is that fair?
The common theme here is hawkish isolationism. All hawks on China, all skeptics on pouring more US treasure into Europe, as they think the Biden team has done in vain in Ukraine. In the Senate, I spoke to Trump loyalist Republican Senator Josh Hawley, who says Washington's allies in Europe might have to fight more of their own battles in future, as America is looking the other way.
The United States has got to focus its attention, our attention geopolitically, on China. We just have to. They're our number one threat. We're the only nation in the world that is able to go toe-to-toe with China. We will assist with the conventional defense of Europe. But we just have to be honest. The United States cannot both lead the conventional defense of Europe and also lead the conventional defense of Asia. We just can't do both of those things. We can't.
The incoming Secretary of State wants likened Britain, France and Germany to American welfare recipients when it comes to defense, saying the conservative solution is to put them on a work program. Another Trump ally, Katie McFarland, Deputy National Security Advisor in his first White House, believes it's time for Europe to accept that Ukraine should negotiate.
Ukraine is slowly losing this war. And Russia, as long as energy prices are high, Russia has the windfall profits to pay for this war. And it's a war of attrition.
But there is and has been a principal position that the West has tried to take here, which is about international law, that you don't just go and grab territory and get to keep it just because you're more powerful. Isn't this just going to be an erosion of that really important historical principle?
If you look at how this war came about, and I think you're absolutely right, everything you said about Russia, they're the aggressors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But give me a plan where Ukraine wins. How do you achieve that other than having the United States be militarily involved or NATO being militarily involved? I think President Trump, throughout his career, even before he got into politics, was never a war guy. He's always been someone looking for how do you settle conflict? How do you not go to war?
The doors are closing.
Well, it tells you something about the scale and the scope of American government. The underground in the Senate is a train, an underground train that runs between the senators' offices and the chamber itself, which we're now on, heading towards the Senate chamber in this time of transition. And at the end of the line, the Democratic Senator, John Fetterman.
It's a bad day for Ukraine. It's I'll never understand. I mean, it's been an ongoing war on democracy, and I can't imagine why anyone could turn our back on Ukraine. But that's what America voted for.
Someone else who's watched Washington's foreign policy fluctuate between administrations but is now bracing for severe turbulence is the historian of U.S.-Russia relations, Mary Elise Cerati. She says Trump's approach to NATO remains unpredictable.
He pulls out formally, which I think is unlikely. He just de facto guts it, but NATO can recover in 4 years, or he de facto guts it and NATO cannot recover. And this goes back again as a historian to a larger debate that we used to have in this country. We in the United States are deeply fortunate because in the North we have Canadians, in the South we have Mexicans, in East and West we have fish. In other words, we don't have major hostile powers on our borders. We need to start the territorial defense of the United States on the far side of our oceans, and that means NATO. And yet another way that Trump is breaking with precedent is he has renewed that debate. If NATO falls apart, basically from neglect, then I think we would be in a very, very dangerous position.
The guardrails of Donald Trump's first term, the generals in his cabinet he'd picked, who aligned more closely with the conventional US approach towards Europe, are gone. Those due to run his foreign policy now are ultra-loyalists, and getting his way with the world looks like an easier run this time round.
Tom Bateman in Washington. That's it from NewsHour from all of us here. Thanks for listening.
When we left, there was this wonderful feeling, but it was only the beginning of a nightmare.
This is a story that started with a job advert. A yacht owner looking for a crew to sail his recently renovated boat from Brazil to Europe.
For me, it was going to be a great adventure and an opportunity to gain a lot of experience.
But when police raided the vessel and discovered drugs...
Cocaine, hidden under one of the beds.
It can't be.
A key suspect was miles away.
Everything revolved around him.
Who's the boss? A British guy. Fox.
Fox.
This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.